You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Indie Film Academy podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart.
Today, we are talking with Chris Soth, the author of Million Dollar Screenwriting and the Mini Movie Method. And we're going to talk a little bit later about what the Mini Movie Method is and how you can use it to help you with your screenplays. I'm not going to go into that now, but you definitely want to stick around and learn about that. It's a way of putting your screenplay together, the structure and everything that I had never really heard of. And Chris, pretty much he is the inventor of this method of putting a movie together into these mini movies. All right, let me get to the episode. Here is Chris Soth.
4 years ago, a man named Randall Earl Shays stole $37 million and left 17 men and women buried alive. 6 hours ago, he disappeared from the state penitentiary with a team of five deadly felons. At this second, somewhere in the Wyoming wilderness, the storm is about to hit.
Canadian firefighters.
We have about 10 hot acres in Delta 4.
Now, the best smoke jumper ever to battle a blaze.
Take me down.
He's about to find out there's a lot more to fight than just fire.
In case you haven't noticed, we're not firemen.
We saw some ground pounders running through the woods.
It was a prison break.
There's a girl with him.
I know. She's a hostage.
Kill her.
Seeing them again.
Why don't we see if you're still not afraid?
Those two fires will collide and suck all the oxygen out of the air.
He won't survive.
He'll be in the middle of a firestorm.
On January 9th, fight fire with fire.
You are ticking me off!
Firestorm.
Smoke jumper! You're still alive!
So what I wanted to focus on, first of all, is a little bit about your background in screenwriting and, you know, where how you got into screenwriting from the beginning.
Sure, absolutely. I guess I've been sort of a nut for story and structure since I was a kid. I was an undergraduate major in drama, and I started studying, you know, plays and play structure there as well, though I wanted to be an actor at the time. And I just felt like, you know, there was something better and we could know more about this than we had been given by Aristotle and was kind of out there in the general knowledge pool. And I did ply my trade as an actor for about 10 years, also as a comedian and a magician, and started writing in my own material and started using some of this story structure that I had studied to, you know, to make that material a little better. I sort of found if I was doing a 6-minute comedy set, if I told a little story or there was a story shaping the whole thing, I didn't have to be as funny. So, where that made it funnier. And, I would do that and started reading up on that and wrote a novel. I worked on cruise ships, actually. I was, you know, doing those comedy acts there, and I had plenty of free time. So I wrote a novel with that free time, and then I wrote the screenplay of that novel. And after that, I, you know, the bug had bitten me, and I had to know everything about screenwriting. Started reading all the books. At that time, there were about 3 of them, and now, of course, there are 300. And I come sort of from an academic family, and if you want to do something in my family, by and large, you go to school for it. My dad's a college professor. So I went back to school, University of Southern California Film School, and that's where I found a far better structure method, which they call sequencing there, which I, you know, use and have, you know, studied and gone in depth with ever since, and sort of heightened and refined to the mini-movie method. And I was very lucky at USC that I wrote a screenplay there that was my thesis in the graduate screenwriting program, and that sold for $750,000, and that became a movie called Firestorm. You know, very fortunate to, you know, have one of those big splashy spec sales. It was on the front page of Variety and Hollywood Reporter the next day. Very fortunate to get the movie made, and lucky enough to ply my trade in Hollywood ever since. And have kind of always taught as well. I mentioned I come from an academic background and started teaching at USC shortly after I left, taught at the UCLA Extension. And what I found was, outside of USC, people were not getting this method, this better way of breaking stories down. To sort of give you the overview of the method rather than 3 acts, which is taken from playwriting. The mini movie method breaks a story down or a screenplay down into 8 mini movies. So if we take, you know, that 2-hour time frame of, 120 minutes, we have 8 15-minute chapters, or 8 mini movies that all add up to the story of the movie. And maybe as I say this, you're thinking, of movies you've seen, or you can remember some movies you've seen where you felt like, you know, doing a certain visual cue or music cue that you've been given by the director or the filmmakers. Oh, something has ended. Everything's changed now, and something new is beginning. Right? So at the end of Act 2, you know, the cop's partner will be killed, and, you know, he'll look at the, you know, into the sky and holler, no. Right in the, you know, that long, drawn out way, right? And the camera pans up into that God shot, because that's what he's talking to God. You say, no, God, how dare you do this, right? Well, that's generally around the end of Act 2, or what I would call Mini Movie 6. And it's kind of said, you know, one chapter is ended, and another chapter is beginning. And the music will swell, too. But, you know, that there are actually 8 of those. And good stories have a structure that, of 8 different tensions, of breaking the main tension of the story down to 8 different tensions, each based on a hope and fear on which the, you know, the outcome of the main story will rely. And once you've had that breakthrough, it becomes much simpler. I mean, it's never easy to write a story, but let's say this is about 8 times easier. That really helps you out. So that's kind of, as you were saying, you know, people specialize in different areas. That was where I found the need and the niche where I said, well, wait a minute, this isn't the industry standard. Everybody should be doing this. This is so much simpler, so much easier. You know, why aren't all the screenwriting books written about this method?
Right.
I don't know how much, you know, you dabble in screenwriting or your listeners do. I know we're talking to all kinds of filmmakers here, but if you want to tell a story, this is going to help you.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, if you've ever heard, you know, Acts 2, if you read your first screenwriting book and said, okay, you write 30 pages, that's hard enough. And you've got that landmark of the Acts 1 turning point, right? And now your reward for that is you get to write 60 more without any sort of landmarks to guide you on your way. you know, that's a nightmare. And I think everybody knows that Act 2 is where good screenplays go to die, right? You know, right. I mean, how many movies have a promising start and kind of falter in the second act? I can tell you, you know, for every movie that does that, there are 1,000 screenplays that did and didn't make it to the screen, right? And died there in the second act. And this is the way, you know, this is a great way to kind of keep your second act hopping, right? And really right. have a tension and a build and you know, build to a really strong climax and have, you know, little mini climaxes and mini movies along the way as each tension resolves and turns. So
now do you chart that in some sort of way where you, you know, say, okay, the first mini movie needs, this needs to happen. The second mini movie, this, you know, do you give a general guideline of the things that need to happen along the way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, after, you know, hundreds of years of stories and over 100 years of movies, really thousands of years of stories and about 100 plus years of movies, we can kind of figure this out. And the method actually comes from the fact and we sort of, it starts to emerge. Because I would argue good stories always did this, but kind of by accident. And I think that, you know, what's making them good starts to emerge, when, you know, by serendipity, film starts to be shot on reels and a reel holds, you know, pretty close to 15 minutes of film. And the early filmmakers, as they develop what becomes the modern day feature film, you know, find it advantageous to plot out a chapter per reel. Right. So, I don't think, you know, Samuel Goldwyn was ever, you know, chomping a cigar saying we got a problem in Act 2. He wouldn't have known what an act was. And I don't think Ben Hecht in the Golden Age of Hollywood was saying that either. I think he was saying we got to fix the fifth reel. So there's absolutely a template and a pattern, that, you know, between me and, you know, Joseph Campbell and, you know, a lot of other people who have studied stories and folklore. We can say Mini Movie 1 is very typically going to do this. Mini Movie 2 is going to typically do this. And you can identify it sort of in a broad generic way, mainly because of, you know, where it is on the timeline, right? If a story if a mini movie is the beginning of the story, there are certain obligations and tasks it has to perform, introducing the main character, setting the main tension, showing this world. Things like that. There's, you can generate a checklist pretty easily. Likewise at the end, and then it's sort of, you know, filling in that middle where, you know, things are more stretches. But there's a much more, you know, detailed template than that, that I give in my book, $1 Million Screenwriting, The Mini Movie Method, that is actually available on Amazon relatively recently. You used to only be able to get from my website about 10 times the price. So I advise everybody to check that on Amazon. And you can identify, those, you know, kind of broadly and generically. And then you can sort of separate them by genre too. You can say, okay, well, are they, in a monster movie, this is kind of the thing that starts to be happening. Yeah, that starts in we see in Mini Movie 1 and come up with different patterns as well. Likewise, in a love story, right? Those three famous Hollywood sentences, boy meets girl, right? That tends to be the end of Mini Movie 1. Boy loses girl. We all kind of know that at the end of Act 2, where that heartbreak occurs. And then boy gets girl will be somewhere there in the third act, in movie 7 or 8. So, you know, those are plot points they're talking about. When they say right. boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, right? So yeah, there is a general pattern and it breaks down, by genre. And then, you know, in my mentorship program, that's screenplaymentor.com. Feel free to check it out. I will guide you, you know, step by step, not through just, you know, the genre of story that you're doing and not just what all stories do, but what your specific stories do. And I feel like that's what we all have to master. We all have to master story in general, then that dictates the genre, and then we have to find what our own unique story is to tell and how it is best told, because that's what's going to differentiate it from all the other stories of the genre and all the other stories in the world, right?
Right. Now, what I was wondering if you could do, just to give an example of the eight mini movies in action, is there a movie in particular that you use to demonstrate those eight mini movies, just so that people can have an idea of how it breaks down?
I don't know that I have one absolutely by heart and by memory, but I know the notes I'll go to when I'm asked this question. I probably could pitch you one of these two movies entirely from memory and give you all eight of the mini movies. But if people are hearing this, are saying, "Well, now that's interesting. I'd like to see that in action. What movie could I look at?" Absolutely, the movie Seven.
Okay.
When I first heard that conceit, I think I was in my second year of grad school at the time, and I interviewed Arnold Copelson, who had bought the script, and he said, "Oh, it's about a serial killer who is killing people in the mode of the deadly sins," right? And I immediately knew, oh, well, that's one deadly sin from any movie.
That's right.
And it almost is. It's a little more sophisticated than that. But once in a while, when I get, I get an idea like that, where there's sort of a number, right in the concept that is, very close to seven or eight, and I say, or six, and I say, well, okay, now my story is three quarters outlined, right? That story is seven eighths of the way to outline. It's slightly different than that in that I don't have it by memory so much that I can say, mini movie three is, Lust, right? So that's a pretty good guess, actually. Really six of the mini movies of seven are all sort of short films leading up to a ghastly tableau. In which someone has been killed, that is staged to look like a decline of one of the deadly sins. That happens six of the eight times. And it is a full, eight mini movie structure. They knock one off right away in the pre-credit sequence because the first scene is Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman showing up at one of these. Now they only have six left. That mini movie ends with another one. And then when you get to mini movie four, that's all about chasing the killer. They're on the track of the killer there, and he shows up at the police station with his fingerprints cut off. Kevin Spacey is the killer they call John Doe. And then he escapes them. That's mini movie four. So two of them are knocked off, by putting two in mini movie one. And one is eliminated in movie four, and the other six each demonstrate a mini movie. So if I had that brilliant idea, I would just say, okay, well, this is the Lust mini movie, and that is the Sloth mini movie, and this is the Gluttony mini movie. And I would let the tension define that, and I would let that scene infuse the pages I was writing. And Seven is very well written and doesn't appear to us as episodic at all, because it's all sort of, all of those pearls are hung on the string of catching one serial killer who has perpetrated all of these acts, right? And we learn a little more about him each time. So there's a great example, a very good movie and a very good screenplay that sold the respect using this method. And I feel like you have sort of a little laugh of recognition when I said that. They were kind of like, oh, of course. But we don't experience, the movie that way and go, oh, well, this is just formulaic. We go, oh my God, this is cool and dark and twisty, right? Likewise, a winner of Best Picture and Best Screenplay, I'm probably a little older than you are. I remember it from my childhood, from its original release, seven Oscars, swept the Oscars, that year. a great period con man movie called The Sting.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So in The Sting, at least through the second act, title cards come up that give a title to each mini movie. So there in that all important second act, I think it actually goes into the third act too. I could be wrong about that. So that second act is chaptered very specifically with tension that are all almost exactly 15 minutes long. So you'll really see it there, and you'll see it in the second act where it's so important that things don't get static, that you haven't been trying to resolve the same tension too long, that it has evolved a little bit, or the stakes have risen, that your heroes are now trying to do something different to solve the problem. The second act is where, as an audience or a reader, we can kind of look at our watch saying, well, we've kind of been static for a long time. Nothing's really changing here. Let's quicken the pace, guys. So they're all chaptered quite specifically. And it's a great one for you to see and study because, hey, best screenplay, best picture, right? So I could go into more detail about that. I could pitch it to you by memory. I don't know if it's, our best possible study here, but, go take a look at it yourself. Just quickly, at the end of the movie one, the Robert Redford character wants revenge against the gangster who killed his con man partner. At the end of two, he enlists the Paul Newman character to help him. Now that's what you've probably been taught to call act one in movies one and two. They're going to pull the big con on this gangster. And to do that, I think Paul Newman says this in the first act. We've got to set the hook so we can, tell him the tale, then we can pull the wire and that'll sting him, right? And those are the four title cards. They are the hook, the tail, the wire, and the sting. And they're all sort of mini cons they have to pull along the way to pull off the big con, which is ultimately the sting into which the movie takes its title. So the con and getting the money from the mark is called the sting, and that's the tension way up there in mini 7 as you break up the third act. I just said one and two are what you've heard called the first act. Then movies 3, 4, 5, and 6 are what is called the second act, and movies 7 and 8 are what you've heard called the third act. That's all that. So you'll see, we divide this by 15, 120 pages or minutes by 15. You'll see that, two of my plot points are the ones you're familiar with, the end of act two and the end of that, the end of act one and the end of act two. The tension of the hook is they got to hook the mark in to want to be in this con, which he will actually think is he's the con man. So they got to set the hook in, this ish there. And our tension is we hope they can. We fear that the whole con will be blown because he'll be along to what's going on. So does that make sense? And I did it as an exercise within 7 too. I actually recommend this to my clients and my students and anybody out here who, wants to use the mini movie weapon. It's a good exercise to title each of your mini movies. You're going to title your movie. Your movie will have a title. Why not give your mini movie a title? So I said, I'd call that the Pride, mini movie, right? Mini movie called Pride and 7. Now they don't have title cards come up with 7, right? But they literally do, in this thing, great Scott Joplin, Marvin Hamlisch score will come up and a little title card, with sort of a Norman Rockwell-ish, image from the coming, mini movie will come up and it will say The Hook, right?
Right.
And it really, creates in your mind as you're turning a page and came to chapter 5 and you have title, it creates sort of a preparation in the viewer's mind that, oh, we're coming to something new. Okay, so something has ended. Something new is beginning. Now, that's not going to work for every movie because that's a stylistic way of telling a story. In some movies, you know, you want to go by it so fast and not have that quaint, it's a new chapter sort of feel, that we experience them seamlessly. And it's a little harder to see these plot points and these turns in tension. But they are there. They are nonetheless there. And they're, you know, working to support the story much better.
Now, what is your process when you're creating a screenplay? How far do you go with outlining and creating somewhat of a blueprint before you actually get into the, you know, the writing phase?
You know, it depends. And it is anywhere from absolutely outlined to, you know, where writing the screenplay is an afterthought to jumping in having one 8-sentence outline. And that, you notice I keep using that number 8, right? And there are 8 mini movies. So I wrote Firestorm, the screenplay that sold for $750,000, that made me over $1 million, in a long haul, just with those 8 sentences. And what they were was just a turning point I would jot down to end each mini movie. Right. Mm-hmm. So, now do I outline in more detail than that? I do, but I might do it in process. So if I, so it kind of depends on the work situation I'm in and sort of my mood. If I can't wait to get writing, I might, you know, brainstorm those 8 turning points and dive in. If I'm working with a studio or other producers or collaborator and it's a good idea that we all are on the same page, and understand, you know, that what the story is going to be, I mean, there, you know, in a lot of detail, I might create a treatment that is quite detailed. The most I would ever create without being paid for it is, again, an 8-page treatment. And it won't shock you to learn that's 1 page per mini movie, right? Mm-hmm. So, my collaborator who, you know, with whom I will acquaint, you know, I'll acquaint my, anybody I like with the mini movie method. But when I'm working with a client, it's sort of up to them. And I'll say, listen, you can bring in an outline for, let's do our brainstorm when we come up with these 8 turning points of the mini movies. And I might say next week, blow each of those sentences up into a paragraph. And then maybe blow each paragraph up into a page. And then we're going to take each of those, pages of prose written in treatment style, and we're going to blow those up into the 10 to 15 pages of the screenplay. That's a very typical process for me. Now, when I'm writing myself, as I said, I might just jot down the turning, all in it. So, it would be kind of like you just heard me do for this thing. At the end of movie 1, his partner is killed. At the end of movie 2, he gets a new partner. At the end of movie 3, he had set the hook, right? Now, I'll know what that means. And I'll have it scrawled on the back of an envelope somewhere. And then I might actually start writing the scripts. But I will do more outlining. It's just sort of in process. In process. Which means, when I get to that mini-movie that, wasn't really very full in my mind, I get to very often that's movie 5. For me. I get to my midpoint. I've always got, which is the end of movie 4, do the math, right? On the strong midpoint, 5 to me still sometimes the most amorphous movie within that second half of Act 2, which is, one of those places that screenplay is going to die. And I will outline the mini movie in more detail. And that might start with, brainstorming a list of highlights, which will become a list of scenes. I might actually, if I'm really sort of up against it, break the mini movie down into micro movies, which means, these 8 steps of structure that I have are kind of the structure of everything. If you're going to work on attention in 15 minutes, the steps are going to be the same, if smaller, than if you work them out over 120 minutes, right? And the ratio will be the same. So about, 1/4 of the script will be, the beginning, and then we'll reach the end of the beginning about 1/4 of the way through, et cetera. That's kind of the golden mean or ratio of storytelling or drama. So I might then outline further, but to me, those 8 turning points are key.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
The analogy I've been using recently is it's kind of like having a map quest for the journey that you're going to go on your screenplay. Your screenplay is going to have 8 turning points. Maybe a map quest has 8 turns. Well, I happen to live in San Diego County. If I'm driving up to L.A., I'm probably going to go on the 5. And depending on where I'm going to go in L.A., I'm going to have to get off the 5 at some point. I kind of don't care, at least at the beginning, and even on most of the drive, how long I'm on the 5, if that's going to be, 70 miles or something like that. I care about that turn where, my off-ramp, because I know I'm going there, and I know that I can figure out the drive. That's going to be kind of a straight shot. And whenever we used to give directions, if you, come from an age before MapQuest, it was always, you keep going on this road and take a right off. We very rarely mention how long it's going to be. We might say a long time,
right?
Or that it's going to be a quick left. But the turns define the shape and the turns define the journey. And when I have those, I really know the shape of my story. I can fill in the details, along the purple line of the blue line of MapQuest or Google Maps as I go.
Now, do you have any exercises once you have your outline and everything? Do you just rely upon the writing process for creativity to come out? Do you have any tricks for kind of like putting yourself into a creative mode, or is it just something that comes out as you're writing?
Well, one of my favorite quotes is from Stravinsky, and it is, "The muse will only visit when she sees you are hard at work." working hard and doing the work, if you expect that bolt from the blue to strike, I think it will come sort of when you're in the zone, or you'll cross over into the zone when you are doing the hard work. The muse is fickle, and sometimes that hard work does not cause her to descend from the heavens. And I think, having a craft and having a series of best practices and principles that you can reliably put into place is the core and the very base of what is called professional. You know the story is going to be very good or, quite good because you know these principles and you have an aesthetic and you know what good is. And then, the muse only has to come and breathe into you a little bit to cross over to great, maybe. And I think if you actually do study the great movies, even if that writer did have that bolt from the blue that gave them that brilliant idea, and they weren't, assiduously practicing a craft and, doing the grunt work that it takes to do that, after they have, you can dissect it. And by and large, a lot more than people are willing to admit in the arts, dissect it and see what makes it great and duplicate it in your own work. And that's why I think movies and stories and television are getting better and better. Partially by the sheer volume that we have, partially by the technology that allows us to generate multiple drafts faster and easier. And just a better understanding of what makes it good. There is, working against that always the fact that, once a great story has been told, you can't really tell it exactly that way again. You gotta come up with a worthy, reinvention, or let it be your inspiration for something else that is also good. Or you are hoping great. As far as that goes, hitting the creativity and being in the zone, I think of myself as a craftsman more than I do as an artist. And so to have them interview that and to really study this is, I hate to say this, almost a way to MacGyver around not having to have the muse strike. I don't want to say not even not having to have creativity, because these are the nuts and bolts of creativity that we study and the craft that we, you know, dedicate ourselves to, right? So it is creativity. I mean, and as far as that, you know, the brainstorming that, you know, that you do and, you know, just trying to get yourself, you know, in a creative mode, I find hard work is the best thing. But if I'm not doing that and I want to, like, just get ideas, because that, you know, you probably heard that, that dictum of, you know, 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration, right? Having the craft and having the aesthetic and having the, you know, the best principles and a hard work ethic, that all fits in the 99%. The 1% is that inspiration of the great idea, right? I think. And I for that, I watch a lot of movies. I read a lot of books. I do a lot of reading. I try to keep myself stimulated. You know, I have friends in a writing group, and I have, you know, very intelligent people that I try to, you know, keep in my life that really provides, you know, stimulating conversation with. And in my own mentorship program, screenplaymentor.com, you know, I work with, you know, dozens of clients who are great writers that I'm always having stimulating conversations with. And after you have the one big idea, right, that 1% of the process, you have to have a million other little great ideas too. And so you have, you know, other smaller 1%. You need the good idea for how to do this scene, with, you know, which is inspiration as well, and the good idea for how to do this mini movie, and the good idea for this plot twist, or ideally the great idea for that plot twist that nobody's ever seen before. So you're continually challenging yourself that way. And, you know, I don't know, in a way, I don't want to demystify it. But I do want to demystify it, really. I feel like that word creativity, you know, and waiting for the muse to strike is sort of an ego trip that a lot of writers and other people in the arts take that, and they sort of mystify it, so that it can be a holy and religious experience for them. And they can, you know, maybe, you know, put themselves a little above other people who don't have it or don't get it. Right.
Right.
And, you know, I would much rather say, let's demystify it. You can do it, and you can find great ideas with those screenplays if you just follow these steps. And, you know, I, you know, who sold the screenplay for $3 million, it's not magic. I'm not better than you. You can learn the same things I learned, and, you know, and maybe not sell a screenplay that's worth $1 million, but write one that is as good, or better as one that did. And I you know, far prefer that, to sort of the, you know, elitism that comes with, you know, creativity and, you know, what people call brilliance and inspiration. You know, God has chosen to favor me with his brilliant idea. Therefore, you know, I lord it all over all of you. Hey, congratulations. You know, you had a good idea. You're going to have about, you know, a million of those to have a screenwriting career. So get back to work.
Now, do you feel like deals like that still exist? I mean, it seems like that's kind of like, I mean, even for the day, it was very, kind of, you know, bizarre and kind of unique in its own way. But it's like, it seems like that kind of thing, you know, that world of filmmaking is kind of a bygone era at this point.
Unfortunately, you know, they do still exist, but they are, you know, as you say, they were rare back then, and they are even more rare now. And this has happened, you know, I think in my lifetime, in my screenwriting career. If we, you know, want to put our fingers on why, I would argue, you know, that it's always, it's not even really that, you know, a lot of specs got bought for a lot of money, and some of them turned out badly.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's part of it. But the truth is, movie studios, just since I've been working in Hollywood, have become more corporate. Mm-hmm. So, 20th Century Fox became part of News Corp, right? And Paramount became part of, some of the Redstone gigantic media conglomerates. They all of the movie studios became, used to be their own corporations and sell their own stock, and have their own shareholders. And they got bigger and bigger and became, just a small part of some vast media conglomerate, of which there are only, 4 to 6 now. And it is harder to justify to your shareholders that you bought a screenplay for $1 million and then went and lost $100 million on the movie, than it is to say, we thought it was going to work. It was by the writer of Harry Potter. Right. Or whatever, whatever else it's been successful in another medium, in a publishing company that our media conglomerate owns. It's the bestseller over here, right? So, it's a video game that our company also owns. It's based on a song that the music branch of our vast media conglomerate, of which the studio is a small piece, owns. So that synergy, is kind of what has replaced the odd spec fail and the journeyman screenwriter who kind of wins the lottery.
What advice would you have for screenwriters to how to get their screenplays read and how to get how to try to have a career as a screenwriter?
Sure, I think that you want to write those big scripts. Spec screenplays, and you want to play that lottery, while at the same time you have other works in your portfolio that are smaller budgets and will go to smaller conglomerates or outfits that aren't conglomerates but are still profitable. So what do I mean? Well, I think it might be worth everybody to take a look at a book called The Long Tail, right? So it's sort of about how the market is shifting. And The Long Tail refers to the tail at the end of a bell curve on a graph about who's making the money in a business, right? Mm-hmm. So as that graph, swells up high and we see there's Paramount and Disney and Universal making billions of dollars in the entertainment business. And as they have become more corporatized, and aren't, $100 million used to be a blockbuster, right? And a studio kind of only wants to make a movie these days if they think the upside is $300 million, and that's domestically, $300 million, pardon me. And, as they've moved out of the movies that merely make $100 million business, that has left room for us on the long tail, to make movies, and go to entities with our screenplays that might be making movies for $10 to $40 million that are only going to make $100 million. And mm-hmm. the opportunity there where hedge funds are stepping in and, other, conglomerates are stepping in with, cash liquidity, where the studios have abandoned it and smaller conglomerates can move in, that's where your opportunity is. Are they a little harder to find? Yes, they are. Are you have to do a little more work, be a little better connected? You probably are. On the very far end of that same long tail is your friends who all want to make a movie for $10,000. And these are the kind of scripts you can write and fund yourself. And in between are, every number of budgets from, $10,000, which I should have picked as the lowest you can make a movie for, and is probably not the lowest for you, everything between 10,000 and 40 million, and between 40 million and what the studios make movies for, you know, there's room as well. So there are other entities stepping in the profitable areas that the larger studios have abandoned. Now, are you going to sell a screenplay for $1 million to any of those entities? That will be rare at first, and I am thinking, you know, might come back again. But you know, could you make, you know, many more millions of dollars if you are a producer on such a movie and you raise the funding for a movie? And are a profit participant, in a screenplay you also wrote, but, hyphenated, you know, and became a writer producer on. That's what I am attempting to do now. That's where I think, you know, my next $1 million is, and I hope my next tens of millions of dollars are, and a higher level of creative control and fulfillment as well. So, and I'll say this, I spent many years as a writer and, of course, had that first blush of success quite early on. That was very exciting and caused me to write, you know, in that genre and at that budget range, you know, for my next 10 screenplays. I'm now as excited by the creativity it takes to get the movie funded and made as I once was by the mere creative challenge, what is more traditionally called the creative challenge of actually writing the script and deciding the events that will take place in it. Finding the funding for a movie, building a following, you know, as I have amongst writers and people who want to partner in filmmaking with me, has been, you know, a very, once I had that breakthrough to realize these could be the same thing. These are just all just challenges, that are begging creative solutions. Once I realized it was the same thing, I can get as excited about, seeking funding for a film as I can for the original idea, for the film. The former is just a little more, how shall I say, out of my hands, than the other, because of course I don't have millions of dollars at my own disposal yet.
Now, how do you feel about places like Inktip and the Blacklist, and what, do you have a resource that you use, for example, if you have a screenplay that you want to get out, or is it just a question of trying to get it in the right producer's hands? I mean, talking about strictly working as a writer.
Strictly working as a writer, I recommend all of those sources. I have gotten a lot of work myself through Inktip, including a movie that was made that I appeared in. And my own experience with Inktip is I got a lot of work on it. I don't know that I actually listed my own scripts on it, because I've always had agents and managers, since that first big spec fail, to get my scripts read. I do hear lots of great stuff about as a resource. I had a movie made that I wrote an assignment, from the Inktip newsletter. That was my second produced credit after Firestorm. And I know a lot of people who have had their script picked up, you know, in an official way. The Blacklist, newer on the playing field. My guess is it's going to become something very good, certainly with that brand and being sort of recognized as quality. I think it should do well. I'm a little less, familiar with their business model. I actually know people that Inktip and speak to them regularly. That hasn't been the case with the Blacklist as yet. So, okay. But I recommend all of those resources. You know, always saying caveat emptor. But you know, I am one of those resources myself. I'm much more about the craft of the screenwriting than I am about the marketing. But certainly, if you write a script with me through screenplaymentor.com, I'm going to advise you on the marketing and help you craft a great query. And coach pitching as well, as a guy who's, sold multiple pitches myself. So, I think these resources are a great idea. I'm a piece of that. But like anything else, there are good ones and there are bad ones. And, the bad one for you may be the great one for me. And so it all, I think, you know, kind of depends. And I regard all these people, you know, as my colleagues and not my competition.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
We're all part of, you know, the same machine that is trying to get, you know, movies made and writers to hone their craft and to get their work seen and make movies and television and novels and any other media better.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as well as being a writer of fiction myself, you know, I'm creating, you know, nonfiction books about the craft of writing and other nonfiction materials about the craft of writing all the time. And, you know, to make the art better, and I would even like the art of creating those books, and, you know, I would like there to be better books on screenwriting and story structure, and that's why I'm, you know, contributing those. I obviously think that there's a better method than the dominant paradigm out there, and that is, you know, my message in that arena.
Okay. Well, what do you think about, for example, like Save the Cat and that kind of thing?
I knew Blake and he was a colleague, and we sort of emerged on the market at the same time and kind of from the same need, you know, which is mm-hmm. to say, you know, the three act structure is not, sufficient to our task.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna fall apart in act two there. And, Blake, so I like Save the Cat. I mean, I really like anything that makes it easier. And, you know, I recommend kind of everybody and all of my colleagues, as I say, to my students and say, you know, or to anybody who asks me as a writer, I say, you know, you're gonna read all of these books, eventually in a long career as a writer, just like you're gonna have to have millions of ideas. And you don't know what book is gonna give you the idea for a new movie, or you don't know which book is going to solve the problem that you're having with this screenplay. So when I have a hot project, I'm working on a screenplay, I usually have, back when we did research in books, I would always have, you know, a stack of books that were my research for the project and the latest screenwriting book, there. So I would be, you know, I might do my, you know, research in the morning and then my writing in the, you know, during the day. And then, you know, read a little bit about the craft that I've just been practicing all day, you know, before I go to bed that night. And, you know, I could, you know, point to most of the books I've read on screenwriting and say, oh, well, this thing that I always do, that came from that book. And, this thing that I always say to my students, or, you know, one of my mentorship clients, that came from that screenwriting book, and I always say it on my version of it. If I say their version of it, I say you should go look at Robert McKee's book. Robert McKee's book, I actually, there's one thing that I can actually quote the page number off, which is the one. you know, John Truby, I think has a lot of, you know, great and very original stuff. Mm-hmm. And Save the Cat as well. Some of my students, who, you know, as I say, Blake and I sort of moved at the same time, and some of my students read our books both around the same time, and I feel like I have a student who sent me a spreadsheet that lays Blake Snyder's structure over mine. You heard me say of, you know, of the three act structure, you know, two of my plot points are the end of act one and act two. It's the same thing. I don't say don't use the three act structure. I say use that end of it. And likewise, I would say, you know, if you know Blake's structure, use that and mine. If you know John Truby's 22 steps, you know, figure out where those are going to go as well. You know, if something from McKee is helping you out, lay that into your story as well. I sort of feel like, you know, you study all of this and you synthesize it, you know, maybe into your own method. And maybe you can write a book as well, and contribute something to the dialogue about what makes good screenwriting and what makes good movies. So I quite like, if there's one thing I kind of envy of him, at least for the first couple of years that I was teaching, I always relied on the fact that I was a USC grad. Whenever I departed from what I had learned at USC and said something that was just my own theory, I would make a big point of saying so. Like, maybe this is crazy, but I think. And Blake just, you know, went crazy and gave all of his plot points wacky, wacky names that people still use now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they became part of the language. And it's always very flattering to me when someone says, oh, yes, Infinity 3, particularly when it's someone I've never met, right?
Right.
I always felt like, at least for the first couple of years, you know, if you use the term mini movie method, you just had a conversation with me quite recently. Like, or you just read my book. And now, you know, I'm putting myself out there a little more. I'll get emails from someone that goes, you know, picks up one of the books on Amazon and say, yeah, I've been using the mini movie method for years and I've never met them and never heard of them. I've had some conversations recently. Someone said, oh yes, I always use this method. And, you know, they're in Australia or they're in Canada or somewhere else, the far reaches of the English speaking world. And, you know, and I've never heard of them. And we have never spoken. And we've never spoken or met. And they say, no, we never have. And, you know, when you put yourself out there and start to reach that far, you know, it's very flattering if you're like, maybe I actually am changing the world a little bit for the better.
Well, do you, one thing I want to talk about a little more is going into the movie method, the mini movie method. One of the things that I wanted to talk to that we didn't talk about was the concept of creating tension. And I wanted to get your opinion on how you create tension in each of the mini movies.
Okay. Absolutely. And this is my absolute favorite talk. I probably should have led with it. I hope everyone's to the podcast. You know, I actually would say, you know, you've hit upon what I think is the most important thing I teach. What I get complimented on the most is, oh, this gets me through the second act like nothing else. Right now, it's, you know, four little 15-page steps. I'm never more than 15 pages away from a major turning point. And that's so much better than 60 pages away, right? pardon me. So what is a tension? Okay. A tension is sort of defined by, and I'll even back this up a little more, and I will say that I believe Sigmund Freud was right in his book, The Pleasure Principle, when he said that all pleasure is a release of tension. So pleasure comes from tension reduction. If you get a massage and they're rubbing your shoulders and it's so tense, that feels good. Why? Because the tension is being relieved. If you take a nap, you know, you've got some tension because you're tired and cranky. That's relieving that fatigue of exhaustion. These are Freud's examples coming up here. If you, you know, go to the bathroom, that relieves the tension of a full bladder and bowel. Of course, you know, the physical act of love is a build-up and a build-up and a build-up and a release of sexual tension, right? So if we like anything, it means it's reducing attention. If we like a story, that means it is releasing attention. So you've heard this phrase, dramatic tension. Maybe you didn't know how important it is, right? It's the source of all pleasure we take in drama, not the tension, but the release of it. So a story is going to build and build and build and build dramatic tension and then release it in a surprising and gratifying way. So how do we build up the tension in any movie? Okay, here it is. Here's my magic formula for tension. If you ask me, this is the E equals MC squared of story. This is the equation on which it all relies. Tension equals hope versus fear. In every movie, there's something we're hoping for. You probably heard this called a rooting interest. We're rooting for the hero. And what does that mean? We're rooting for him to get what he wants, probably, which might just be escaping a monster that's trying to kill him, which might mean the heart of the fair maiden, which might mean you know, not to be sexist about it, the heart of that hunky man, okay? So whatever they want, we're generally rooting for them to get it. And we hope they will. We fear not just that they won't.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But that they will suffer great consequence in the attempt of getting it. So in Raiders of the Lost Ark, we really hope that Indiana Jones gets the Lost Ark. We really fear that he shall die in his attempt to get it. And worse yet, that the Nazis will have it and they will become an unstoppable army. Right? So note the stakes that are attached to that hope and fear. Well, that's the hope and fear of the entire movie. That's what I would call the main tension of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right?
Right.
Likewise, each mini movie has a tension on which that relies. So at the end of mini movie one, when the CIA, if the DOSS back then, comes to Indy and says, we need your help. We found this, the word Staff of Ra in this telegram. Indy says, the headpiece on the Staff of Ra, you take it into the map room of Tanith. In Tanith at a certain time of the day, it shows you the location of the Well of the Souls. Well, he, in that line of dialogue, just the way Paul Newman does in The Sting, lays out the tension of the next three mini-movies. The next mini-movie is about him getting the headpiece on the Staff of Ra. We hope that he can. We fear that he shall die in the attempt, and the Nazis will get it. So he gets it successfully. The one after that is all about getting into the map room undetected and finding the Well of the Souls. And the one after that is about getting to the Well of the Souls and then getting the Ark, right? But if any of one of these goes wrong, we're hoping Indy triumphs in each one. If any of them goes wrong, well, the Nazis are going to have the Ark and rule the world. So hope and fear is your technique and is your surefire way to build tension in a movie, in a mini movie, I'll go further than that, in a scene or in any interchange of dialogue or beat of action within a scene. Every little beat of action or every line that somebody says must move the needle on the tension meter, and it's going to swing it from hope to fear or fear to hope, or hope to fonder hope, or fear to even worse fear. And if it's not doing that, then that scene, that mini movie, or worse yet, that movie is static and doesn't have attention and is going to be boring. And that is the worst crime you can commit as a storyteller or a filmmaker. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
To be boring. So
do you go back and like check out a scene and say, okay, this scene is it's kind of like it's okay, but I want to add a little more conflict to it. I want to add just a little more spice.
Absolutely. Yes. I do that all the time. And what is that? That's rewriting and polishing. I mean, I think, you know, when you say you're rewriting, that may be kind of vague, but this is by and large what you're doing, or at least, you know, in this phase of rewrite. So, of course, I'll go to a scene and say, well, okay, well, what else here will make this tension really pop? You know, this line makes me, you know, gives me a little hope, but you know, but the next line is going or beat of action is making me fear it. But how could it give me even more fear? What could make it look like the outcome is even worse? Because as we watch a story or read a story or go through our daily lives, we are constantly trying to predict the future, right? And we're constantly trying to get evidence. Michio Kaku in his book talks about this and talks about how that's an adaptive behavior, right? Why would that evolve, right? Because the people who can predict the future the best are going to survive better and are going to, you know, carry their genes to the next generation and are, you know, going to get all the food and they're going to do very well, right? So that adaptive behavior helps us out. And that's why stories delight us, because they variously fool us and get us caught into that live path of what's happening next, right? So if I give you an event that seems to point towards a very dire outcome, a fear, right, And then I give you another one that makes it even more convincing that that is surely going to happen. And then I spring a surprise because guess what? It happened, but it was 10 times worse than you thought. And I'm exceeding your worst fears at every turn, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's constantly what I'm asking myself. What would raise the stakes on this? What would make this even worse? That's a very good way of putting it.
Or a fonder hope.
But, you know, the way you know, drama is structured, that golden mean of drama, that, you know, 3/4 of the drama will be, of the story, will be convincing us very bad stuff is going to happen. Right? And then stepping into, you know, usually the happy ending, stepping into save the day about 3/4 of the way through, or maybe at the very last one.
Now, talking about creating conflict, I assume that this means what you're saying is once you at the very beginning, you need to establish what it is your protagonist wants, and therefore that's going to be something that drives you through the entire story. Is that
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Right, and that's a tension as well. Right, I mean, their desire line, you know, creates that tension. You know, I said, we're rooting for them to get what they want, right? So there's our hope that they will get what they want. Our fear that they will suffer great consequence in the attempt, right? They'll fail and be destroyed, in some way by it. And this applies, by the way, I mean, I'm using these broad terms that, you know, destroyed, by it. And you know, I write action adventure, so people tend to think, oh, well, this is only going to apply in that genre, but absolutely not. It, you know, if we say their heart is broken, then it applies to a love story. That is, if we define their destruction as that, their heart is broken, they shall never love again because, the one person they could love that they would ever meet here on this entire planet has married another. Well, there's your love story. There's the stakes of, you know, a many a romantic comedy. And, you know, if you don't over literalize me, if you sort of, you know, hear, either literally or symbolically, at the end of these things I'm saying, you will realize they apply to every single story you're ever going to write. And yes, I talk about this structurally, and I kind of see everything as structure because that characters want is really our hope. If you want something, you hope you get it, right? It's the same thing. You know, those two verbs can be used almost interchangeably. I think if you look in the dictionary under hope, you see want or desire as a synonym and vice versa, right? So they're used interchangeably insofar as we talk about character. I think we should be called human wantings rather than human beings. That defines a character and a person so much. If you say, you know, if you and I are talking about a third-party friend of ours, and I say, what's he about? I think you're usually going to answer with, you know, what he's trying to do in his life and what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
So that does define character for us, and that's where character and story are so inextricably bound up and linked.
Now, how does that relate to creating a log line?
Okay. You know, generally, I think a log line, and this is not the template that I specifically use, but I can give you my own template for log lines as sort of, you know, the defining aspect of a movie, maybe not the sexiest pitch, but generally, a log line will be one sentence. The subject will be the protagonist, and it will depict what he wants. And usually have a hint of position. My own template for log lines, I have a full hour lecture that leads up to this phrase, of which this phrase is sort of the punchline. So I hope you're we don't have time for that, so I hope you're will stipulate that I support it well and make my point. But I think the defining aspects are a hero, a villain, and a world, or a protagonist, an antagonist, and a backdrop. So if we said an archaeologist battles the Nazis to control an ancient artifact.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
That's Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? We can get more specific, so it would be, an archaeologist battles the Nazis to retrieve the Lost Ark of the Covenant, right? So that's right in order. A hero, a villain, a world, right? And that's Raiders of the Lost Ark. And the other thing I will say, and the reason I think log lines are important, is only one movie fits that description. And I think that if you've got a good log line, and you slap the question, what's that movie where, then put your log line after it, and then put a question mark at the end, there is only one answer. So what's that movie where the poor boy, I'll rephrase it. What's that movie where the rich girl falls in love with the poor boy on the doomed ocean liner? Everybody, we don't even have to say Titanic. It popped in everybody's head the moment I said that, right? Now I could say on the Titanic and that'd be an even bigger cheat, right? But I didn't because I wanted to pop that movie poster and maybe that horrible song into your head. Right? And you cannot help but answer that. Now, how great a tool is that for you to have as the defining essence, to be even more heady here, the platonic form of what your story and movie is going to be, right? That which your movie is, that no other movie ever has been or will be, could be defined by that sentence. And I think if you get specific about your hero, specific about your antagonist, and specific about your world or backdrop, you'll get. I don't know if you remember the movie plot generator, sort of maybe you didn't see it. I know the writer's store was selling it. You'd probably look it up on Amazon. But it was, sort of three books in one because it had three sets of pages that you could flip. And so as you flip the top one, it changes, then there are two below it, right? Mm-hmm. So you could change an element of a movie. You could generate movie plots with this. And they were basically laid out like that. Although, I was talking about this log line template before it existed. It was basically the top bunch of pages were a hero. The middle were a villain and the third were a world or something they were attempting to do or something like that. So I think that, by and large is the way to generate your log line. And, I will make no bones about it, but for a while there through the 80s and 90s, a lot of people made a lot of money, myself included, by kind of changing the world of Die Hard, right? I flipped it over to Forest Fire, right? And Die Hard in a blank was a great sort of, we saw a lot of those movies and more scripts sold. Back in that day. Now, I also changed the hero, and I also changed the villain, right? But essentially, it was a hostage situation, which is kind of, what Die Hard is. Maybe one of the first to dramatize that through an entire movie, though I think it goes back to, movies called Desperate Hours in the 70s that came up in the 50s and 60s. And the this meets that, right, sort of pitch that we hear in Hollywood, they're always taking, one of those three elements from this and another one or two of them from that. So, you could also, pitch Die Hard, pitch Firestorm, my spec sale, as Die Hard in a forest fire, right? Or you could pitch it as Die Hard meets Backdraft, right? So we're taking that hostage situation and we're putting in the world of fire, taking a protagonist who, battles fire, and sort of the hostage situation. So it's really the situation. So you're already going to say the world, and combining it with the world of Backdraft, which is fire. you know, I pitched it a couple of times. I was writing as a thesis view of the cliffhanger set on fire. So what am I saying? A lot of people running through the wilderness, these were, you know, this really happens to be burning down around them. Which to me, you know, up the stakes even on cliffhanger, right? You know, cliffhanger, which did very well, wasn't set on fire. It would have done better, even more fun. So that's log line for me. A hero, and a villain and a world. Now, you can say a hero battles a villain, and maybe the fourth element is a bird implying conflict. So if you really want to get a more detailed template, a protagonist, subject is a protagonist, the verb always implies conflict, the direct object of the sentence is the antagonist, and then there's a prepositional phrase indicating the world. So to do my own movie Firestorm, a smoke jumper goes up against escaped convicts, the biggest forest fire in Yellowstone National Park's history, exactly those things in the order.
Now, when you're going through something, you know, when you're writing that screenplay, do you go check out Die Hard and say, okay, let me get the screenplay for that and see what beats this is hitting, like what page and things like that?
Absolutely. Okay. Certainly when I was at USC, I was lucky enough to, you know, have access to a screenplay library. I would go get the screenplays, and I probably read for the entire first year that I was at USC a screenplay every single day. And it will not surprise you at all to know that I go through and I reverse engineer from what I would call a structural template in the movie outline, right? Mm-hmm. I will check what's happening on page 15, on page 30, on page 45, 60, 75, 90, 105, and what's happening, you know, in the last pages. And what are those terms? I get the map quest structure of that story. So I'll certainly, you know, read the screenplay, but, you know, I read so many screenplays, you know, that year that I would get them, you know, not just if they were a great structural template, but I would go get them if they just had a similar character to what I was considering, even a minor character. I'd check mm-hmm. those names. I would, there have been, you know, thousands, if not millions of movies. Most of the problems have been confronted and solved to varying degrees of brilliance by somebody. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. Now, can you, you know, if you're very specifically creating a minor character that, you know, is very similar to a well-known minor character, can you do everything that those people do down to feeling their lines or words? No, of course you can't. But they can be your inspiration, and you can isolate principles about why that worked and why that did to a study. So if it was going to be similar in tone to what I was like, I would go read it. And that was another part of sort of my, you know, I only mentioned the reading part of my creative process. I'll watch, you know, after the day's work is done, I'm deep into the screenplay, I'll watch a similar movie too. So, you know, there are certain templates I find myself bringing up all the time to people. Like, oh, you're going to have, you know, you should go make a mini movie outline of this one. And I do when I can, and people write these down, and collect these outlines from starting to archive them as a resource for my computer, screenplaymojo.com. Basic Instinct, I think, is a great for your detective story. And there are some unique structural things it does that have been stolen a lot and continue to inspire. 3 Days of the Condor is, you know, great for a thriller as well, on that spy intrigue. Men in Black is sort of something I mentioned a lot for people to study for, you know, their own quirky, actually, like a secret organization type movie. So if you lots of things have been done before. You're very lucky when you have a really unique idea, but you're also very challenged if there if no one has gone before you down this path. So
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And some movies sort of sail by on that and being sort of a one-er, as they used to say, one of a kind. But I think that the movies that we're seeing these days, by and large, fall into the very gratifying. I don't even want to use the word formulas because it's formulaic is a negative. I don't think of it that way. The polio vaccine is a formula and it's great for us. I need to solve a problem of not getting polio. Please give me something formulaic. So,
right.
I think if you make what people mean when they say it's formulaic and the implication is bad, it's not original.
Right.
So just make originality part of the formula, right? So I say cliffhanger set on fire. Well, if it was just cliffhanger, that would be original. Combining those two elements is what brings the originality. And I would say, if you read my script, you would say raising the bar on action and pace is what made that script worth buying and that movie worth making, whatever the results may have been, when it finally was made. So I think making sure that it's a fresh take and it's original, I don't know that you're necessarily going to reinvent structure.
I did an interview with Brian Yudovich a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that he said that I think is very similar to what you're saying is when they make a movie, and he's a producer, he says basically what they try to do is have 80% of the movie be familiar and then 20% be kind of new with new ideas. So people don't want to watch movies that are 100%, original because they don't even know where to go with it. They want to have something that's familiar, and then they want to have something that kind of surprises them within a template that's already kind of familiar to them.
I think that's absolutely correct. And there are, very original movies that are 100% original, and I generally can't stand them because, they've also thrown a lot of narrative out the door. So,
right.
I mean, lots of people, Cleana Scotti, which is, basically, Philip Glass music and just images from around the world. There's not a character. There's not a story to follow. I don't even call it a movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's also filmed. So I guess we have to call, and it's a moving picture. So we have to call it a movie, but that's not for me. And there's a very small segment of the populace who are, going to, watch and love that. And I think they're getting a different thing from it, than they're getting from what we call a movie. I would almost argue that, Boyhood I actually thought was good this year, but not for all the reasons I normally think a movie is good. I did think it was slow, which I think is, the greatest crime you can commit. And yet it did add up to something. And it was such a worthy project and undertaking and exploration as to, a combination of movies and living life, that I would have been happy if it had won the Oscar. Just to reward the dedication of those filmmakers and those people who showed up those 12 years. And it does kind of add up to something. And, you do kind of feel like, particularly being a parent or a boy, it has a little something to say about life as it's being lived in the early part of this millennium. People who grow up that way. But I almost want to say not a movie, almost its own art form. So there's an example of, two things that are not really movies. That one I don't like and one I kind of did. I don't know, Mr. Linklater would be upset here and say is very fond of work, is not a movie. But
well, I think I read somewhere that he like made a comment about hating plot, you know, and I thought that was interesting that if you watch his movies, he just can't stand plot and likes to, you know, have more organic kind of scenes that don't necessarily hit beats, you know, so right. It's just a different, you know, some people can get away with that.
So few do.
Right.
And listen, I'm not going to see Bullshit again. I'm glad I did, and I'm glad it was done. I think it's never going to make the money the Transformers does, or you know, a lot of other things. So
right. What's well, like what was it? Tree of Life too is kind of like that. You know, just
Tree of Life.
Like,
you know, to this day, this will be telling. I have not seen the Tree of Life to this day because I just fear that I'm going to go pretty. And fall asleep. I don't know. Some people do like it. As far as Malick's work goes, I love Badlands, which was pretty, you know, story driven, and I feel
right.
Sort of defined a genre, you know, between it and Bonnie and Clyde, that, you know, this, you know, young couple on the run pulling heist.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Was defined by that. And, you know, seminal as a certain kind of story. And there's no Natural Born Killers without it. And, you know, certain other, and no Thelma and Louise without it. Certain other stories that we've seen. And I understand, you know, he has a certain Zen philosophy that God laughs or doesn't even notice the tiny small things that men try to do and care about. I get that, you know, Mr. Malick has that viewpoint. And you're probably right. it's true. To me, it doesn't make for the best entertainment, once you've, grabbed it. One of these days, I'll see Tree of Life, probably. I think that, it's better, that's better left to a philosophical discussion for me to really grasp
right.
That idea. And not demonstrated dramatically through story. And you know, certain ideas have a better treatment in other media, I guess. So
let me change gears for a second if I can.
Sure.
I wanted to, since we're coming up on an hour and a half, I want to make sure I hit a few things. A lot of people that listen to this are, you know, starting out as screenwriters and first time screenwriters or people that are struggling to, you know, write their first. Can you talk a little bit about some of the biggest mistakes that you see when you have new students come in that are creating their first screenplay? Are there any common kind of pitfalls that people run into that you see a lot?
Well, you know, I sort of feel like the first step is so often the misstep, which is sort of bad idea selection for what you're going to, you know, write a movie on. And I sort of feel like there are two mistakes people make there. One is not sufficiently differentiated from other movies. They don't even really recognize that it's so similar. It, you know, it doesn't have the 20% in that 80-20 ratio that, you know, that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Or your producer Brian was mentioning. And I will speak to someone and I will say, well, how is that different from this well-known film? And I won't get a good enough answer. And there's this desire to cling to it because you love this idea. And maybe it even got you to be a writer. And if it did that, it was worth it. Is it ever being made? Maybe not. The other is picking something that doesn't have attention to it and isn't going to be a good story when you're done. An idea that's just not a good idea. And having that aesthetic, having studied enough movies to know, what a good idea is, because it's going to provide a great tension and conflict and ideally, yield a theme. I think it's key. I think that's a very common misstep. Then we get to the actual writing, over directing and putting things in the narration that couldn't possibly be acted or dramatized or seen. You know, the things that development executives and are wondering, like, how do I know in the margins about it?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
So, you know, the main character thinks of the time when he was 3 years old and went to the old fishing hole, right? You put that in narration, I've been an actor. I cannot put an expression on my face, even in the close-up. that shows you that I am thinking of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and the over-directing and really having such a strong visual in your mind for everything that goes on, but you put in a lot of things that don't matter to anything.
Can you put in any sort of, I mean, I know that people who are writers and directors, you know, like P.T. Anderson will put camera moves and things into his shooting script. Is that just completely taboo to put any sort of like camera movement or, I mean, can you do like angle on something or focus on?
I think it's becoming less and less taboo.
Okay.
And as you will see more screenplays with it, I'm nonetheless a type of thing. Partially because I'm just an old dinosaur and I grew up saying never do it. Being a book that say never do it, and do it over direct. My opinion on why you shouldn't do it a little different than everybody else's, which is, you know, don't tell the director how to direct. He's going to cross all that stuff out. And he's going to be pissed off at you. My attitude is much more, at least in the spec script, designed to be read. That to put the word camera in it, okay, or angle, is to jar the reader out of what you're hoped, out of the flow state. They should get into such a state reading your script that they forget that they're even reading. It should flow through them. And they should feel like they're a fly on the wall watching, these people have these experiences. And then they should so forget themselves and, lose their self-consciousness so much that there's even not even a fly anymore. There should be no wall. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to just achieve that Zen state of flow, with your reader. And so they should only realize when they get to the script that they were even reading. A director, as Daniel calls it, the dream state. And to say camera, to say angle is to remind them they're watching, they're reading the shooting script for a movie that will ultimately film, but actors are going to be playing these roles and is to take them out of their reality. Same reason I'm against we see and we hear in script. There's no we. Mm-hmm. There is only the flow of the story. You're not, you know, forget that you are watching it and hearing it. Let it flow through. That's what I want to see in the spec script. Now, when that is changed into a shooting script, I have vowed that the next one, I'll probably look in camera directions into, because it seemed perfectly obvious to me that this had to be a close up when I said, you see a tear on its face, but then it wasn't. I wouldn't say you see, I would say tears on its face. So I go to coded stuff like that. If I describe somebody's face, it means a close up. I'm trying to get you into the visual of the movie I have in my head. But I don't actually feel that we see and we hear does that.
So you would just say, instead of like, we hear a car honk outside, you would just say a car honks outside or
right.
Something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Wasn't that an improvement, that second one? Did you hear a car honking when you heard that second one? Yes. In your mind, what's going to be different on the screen in the movie? They're going to be the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, when you were at USC, were there any screenplays that were kind of, did you have any, like, I hate to say this phrase, but any like aha moments when you just like kind of got it for the first time? or when you realized like, okay, this is really someone who has talent, and this is a screenplay that, you know, is going to inspire me.
I read all of William Goldman's works, and it was particularly The Princess Bride. And I actually never read the novel The Princess Bride, but I quite liked the movie, where I said, well, this is an incredible piece of work, and your eyes are just pulled down the page. Shane Black, who, you know, is sort of everybody's idol coming up in the screenwriting world and had, you know, happened to him what we all want to have happen to him, is on record as saying, I read all William Goldman, I read all of Walter Hill. And so I took my writing style from them. And so I made a point of reading all of William Goldman's scripts, and I made a point of reading all of Walter Hill's scripts. And I did have one thing coming up that Shane Black did not have, which was I also had Shane Black. So I read all of his scripts, both produced and unproduced, and a lot of others, as I say, you know, have the slightest element. The two that really stand out as far as reading screenplays go, that it was, I would say the Princess Bride screenplay was so beautiful, it made me cry more than seeing the movie ever has. I'm not quite the cult fan of Princess Bride that everybody else would love it, just not, you know, like, I'm telling you to see it again. And also the movie Field of Dreams, the screenplay for Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. I had seen that movie, it was very emotionally affecting on me, and I went and read it and had at least the same emotion, probably more. So I guess it's, you know, I'm giving you the ones that made me cry. I also read a lot of the ones that give you this emotion, and those probably influence my writing style. I'm not exactly sure what that emotion is, so I'll just sort of give the reaction, which is, whoa, cool! Mm-hmm. I read a lot of those. In fact, my producer said, you're going to carve yourself a niche in Hollywood as the cool stuff guy. and that is what I tried to do, and that's kind of what I learned to write quickly. Now I have written screenplays since that don't make you cry. It's a comedy and a family movie and things like that. And that came a little later. But my ahas and the ones that really stick with me are, you know, what I can remember being on that exercise bike reading, tears streaming down my face, Field of Dreams, The Princess Bride.
All right, now my final question is always the same. I call it the time machine.
Okay.
If you could go back in time and talk to yourself when you were, let's say, 18, 20 years old, what advice would you have for yourself about filmmaking or screenwriting?
Mm-hmm.
Or life in general? No, whatever.
Wow. Okay. Filmmaking and screenwriting, I think I would say start writing now, because I came to writing late. And I'm always very jealous of the people who are that age and know they want to be writers, because I went through two careers before I really started writing. And then I would say, because it is all writing, all of filmmaking is writing, or all of writing and filmmaking and art in general are the same thing, some other thing. And as best as I can determine, there's a relatively recent revelation for me. I certainly didn't know how to get to it. Is they are leveraging the most meaning that you can into the smallest possible piece of information. So into the most meaning you can into a visual, the most meaning you can into a word or words. If you have a line that is 5 words long and quite meaningful, if you can cut one word and lose no meaning, you just increase the ratio of word to meaning, of syllable to meaning, by 20%. And so fill everything with meaning. If I only had 4 words to say that 18-year-old, I would say that about writing, I would say that about filmmaking. I would say that about art. And since you asked, yes, I would say that about life.
Well, Chris, I really, really appreciate you coming on today. And thanks for spending the time with us.
Jason, it's been a real treat. Please send me a link and let me know when it's up. All right.
Just so people know, do you want to put your links up and your how to get in touch with you and find your books and things?
Sure, absolutely. If you search my name, Chris Soap, in the Kindle store, you'd see, I think at this point, 5 books there, and I intend to kind of be publishing it like a Kindle single size book several times a year, maybe as much as once a week. Shortly, I do sort of a regular screenplay mastermind group, and I sort of started to transcribe those and publish them because people said to me, I want that information, please get that to me. So you can find that on Amazon. I have, I guess my flagship website, now is screenplaymentor.com, and, there's another one, milliondollarscreenwriting.com. And if you want to reach me personally, that first name and last name, Chris Soap, CHRISSOTH, @AOL.com or gmail.com. You can get to me either way. Chris Soap at AOL, Chris Soap at Gmail.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. It's been fun.
All right, that's going to do it for today. I want to thank my guest, Chris Soap, for coming on and talking to us about screenwriting. We're going to be covering a lot of screenwriters this week. I still am working on my Roger Corman episode, so I'll have that as soon as I possibly can. But this week, I'm going to focus completely on screenwriting. A lot of people have been writing me and telling me they really like the Corey Mandel, Alex Dean Laris, and I have a lot of great interviews that I haven't released yet from really amazing people just like Chris, who can help you with your writing and give you a lot of great insight. So we're going to continue this week with that. So I will hopefully have another episode either tomorrow or on Wednesday. So look forward to that. Keep downloading, and we will see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.